Accession number 14881, reel 2.
Mr. Nee, reel 2. You were also saying that about something about whispers being a source.
Yeah, well, whispers in the sense of rumours, and people think that they've heard so-and-so, or somebody has reported that this might be true. Particularly, this applies to signals intercepts and that sort of thing, which are often, not corroded, corrupt. They're corrupt. And so you're often guessing at what the actual truth is behind them. But don't forget also that I'm talking about, and this is the only experience I have, because I didn't serve anywhere else, I'm talking about an army headquarters, the headquarters of an army. And so a great deal of information that you're working on at army headquarters has come up from the units under the command of the army. So in particular, the three corps, is it corps or corps? That is... 1 Corps, 8 Corps, and 30 Corps, which formed 2nd Army. And they were constantly supplying information to us. And sometimes, there again, they didn't know how important their information was because they didn't see the bigger picture. And we didn't see the biggest picture of all, which was the one that the Army group saw, where we had to supply information to them. But a great deal of information comes upwards always in this sort of work. And then every night we issued a summary, every night, written in the middle of the night. An intelligence summary putting together in a very readable form, which harassed people. Sometimes even people in the middle of action could read quickly. And that was written every night to say what was going on and what you thought was going on and what you thought was going to happen in the near future.
This would go to the Army commander?
Yes, it would go to the Army commander, but it also went down to the Corps commanders and his staff, and it went up to Army Group and up to Chafe, to Eisenhower's headquarters. So it went in every direction. It went sideways and all around the Army main headquarters itself, the Army commander and various other people like GS Ops and all the other GS, as well as downwards and upwards. But that was a very important thing. I really learned how to write concisely and I think fairly clearly by doing that. Constantly, and again under great pressure of time, in the middle of the night. I wish I'd kept a few of them. I suppose it's not allowed to keep a few of them.
Did you have any inkling about Ultra?
Well, no. The real answer is no. It was a very peculiar situation, as you can well understand. I mean, we know now. All about these things, but when we didn't know anything about it, it was very peculiar. There was a little unit in Army headquarters, which, as far as I recall, went under the name of SLU. And it was said that these initials stood for Special Liaison Unit. And it had a peculiar staff. It was staffed by a mixture of Army and Air Force people. And they appeared very often late at night. And they appeared only to the colonel and the major, that is to say the GSO-1 and the GSO-2. Nobody else. And they appeared to them, and if they came in while you were talking to the colonel, then he would ask you to leave the room. And we knew that these people came in and they gave a bulletin or a piece of paper or something to the colonel. And if the colonel wasn't there, then the major took his place. And I now know that was Ultra. But I didn't know then. And what happened was that you wrote your intelligence summary and the colonel and the major would say... when they read it through, before it was finally passed to go out to everybody, they'd say, that's good. I think we should emphasize that. Or they would say, I'd like you to take that out, if you would. I can't tell you why, but take it out, because that's not true. Or if you said in the intelligence summary that rumor has it that General Model in the German high command is going to take over from General Kluge or something, the colonel would say, we'll take that out, I think, because it probably won't be Model. We've decided that it's much more likely to be somebody. Well, he already knew that Model had been sacked or Model had been sent to the Russian front or something from Ultra. So he of course, was in a situation where he couldn't compromise anything by being more definite than that. And this went on for the whole campaign. And we just accepted that this was part of intelligence. And people used to discuss it in the mess or somewhere. They used to say, where the devil did they get this stuff? How do they know? How do they even have any sort of indication, any clue at all about what's going on? And people used to say, do you know, they must have a mole in the German War Office. I don't think we used the word mole then, but that was what they meant. And we used to say, yes, it must be that, because it's too definite for anything else. And then there'd be the question, can't possibly be a signals intercept. No, it can't possibly be that because of the coding that's being used and so on. And so you never knew, and nobody ever came to a conclusion about it. But of course, if we'd been a bit cleverer, we would have put two and two together, because I knew a number of people at Cambridge who'd already left to work in Bletchley, because half the people in Bletchley came from Cambridge and the other half came from Oxford. They used to say that was why it was put in Bletchley, because it was exactly halfway between the two cities. So, but no, nobody ever really had any inkling.
Why did you think that the German code couldn't be cracked?
Well, one assumed that it couldn't. I think it was wishful thinking more than anything else. But one assumed that it couldn't.
Did you know anything about the complexity of the Enigma equipment that the Germans were using?
No. No, this is the sort of thing that would have come up in some of these high-level technical interrogations, you know. But I never came across that at all. But it was disconcerting, mind, sometimes. To work away all day at something and come to a conclusion that this is likely to happen on such and such a point on the front, or that there's going to be an amalgamation of two units, or the boundary, this was another important thing, the boundary between two opposing units is going to be shifted, because this is one of the things you had to plot very carefully, the boundaries between units, as we did on our own side. You had to be very careful about boundaries, where particularly when it was us and the Americans, for example, or us and the Canadians. And so where there was a boundary, shall we say, between two German corps, then you came to the conclusion, such and such a unit is being moved over, there's evidence of artillery there, and so on and so on. It looks as though they're shifting the boundary. And it was terribly disconcerting for somebody to tell you at something like 2 o'clock in the morning, you're wrong about that boundary. And you'd spend all day thinking this was the answer, you know. This was the clue. You'd had the clues, and this was the answer you'd come up with. It was like somebody telling Hercule Poirot that he'd picked the wrong one out of all the suspects.
But you must have been tempted to contradict them.
Well, yes, but you don't contradict your commanding officer. I mean, in this case, the colonel. No.
If those special liaison unit personnel had been captured, then the Ultra effort would have been jeopardized. Was there any danger of them being captured?
Well, they only worked at a main headquarters, main army headquarters, which is not exactly the front line, mind. I don't, as far as I know, they never worked any lower echelon than that. So it wasn't very likely. But on the other hand, I never knew, and I'd be interested to know now, how much they knew about it. Because although they were there for liaison and for passing on these things, they may have known as little about the source of the information as we did.
Are there any specific coups which intelligence made at Second Army HQ whilst you were there, for which you were complimented?
No. Quite the reverse.
Any rockets that you got?
There were some terrible mistakes made. Terrible mistakes. I mean, the whole business of Arnhem. I mean, there were mistakes made from the operational point of view, I know. Several stupid things were done, particularly by Montgomery himself. But from the intelligence point of view, the failure to warn anybody that there were two SS Panzer divisions very near, more or less resting, pulled back out of the line, and the whole operation was being done more or less on top of them. I mean, this was really an intelligence failure. So this was quite the reverse of complimentary things.
Why do you think that failure happened about the two Panzer divisions?
They were lost. Somehow they were lost. Whether it was they were lost to Ultra as well, I don't know. But they vanished out of the order of battle. And it was assumed they'd been pulled back for a refit or something, and that all they'd done was pull back as far as Arnhem. So that was one thing. The other thing, of course, was the Battle of the Bulge, just afterwards. What was it, 3 months afterwards? That was also, there were some shortcomings there from the intelligence point of view.
But did the rockets, did the reprimands come at your level? Or?
No. As far as I remember, nothing went wrong at my level. As far as I remember, this was pointed out, you know, that there are missing divisions. And then it would be up to Army Group, presumably, to find out where they were.
What were the senior personnel at 2nd Army HQ like to work for as individuals? Any individuals you recollect?
Well, I recollect Selwyn Lloyd. Do you remember Selwyn Lloyd?
Yes.
He was the Chancellor of the Exchequer at one time, yeah. Well, he was the Brigadier General Staff. He was the head of the whole staff at the 2nd Army. He was very aloof, as far as I remember. But on the other hand, I was a lieutenant at that time, and so why would he have noticed me?
Any others that stick out in your memory?
No, not really. The people I worked with were extremely pleasant. They were prepared to make all sorts of allowances for inexperience and nervousness. Jack Ashworth, who was the GSO2, afterwards became a judge, I believe. But he was chancellor. Is that the right word? Chancellor? The legal advisor, anyway, the man in charge of legal affairs for a bishop, for a diocese. Is he called the chancellor?
I don't know.
He was the chancellor of the Diocese of Rochester. So he was a barrister and became a judge after the war. But he was extremely nice, but a bit pernickety, a bit fussy, sometimes fussed about things that didn't matter very much.
Did you meet the army commander himself?
Oh, yes, I met him. MC Dempsey MC. That's what he was known as.
What was his manner to his subordinates?
On the whole, pretty casual. Yeah, pretty casual. He wasn't regarded as being strict at all. Second Army was a pretty jolly place. It had inherited a great deal from the Eighth Army, not only because of Montgomery, but because there were an awful lot of people in Second Army headquarters who came from the Eighth Army. So a lot of the casual attitudes that had been adopted in the desert by Eighth Army and later on in Sicily, they were still with us in the Second Army.
Was the HQ attacked in Normandy or later?
No. I don't think so, no.
You didn't get strafed or bombed?
No, no.
Or shelled?
No. We're very near the front line, of course, for quite a long time, particularly before the breakout in Normandy. Very near. When the fighting was going on in Caen, we were very near Caen. And, well, there wasn't much room in that bridgehead at all. I mean, you imagine there were 500,000 troops or something in it, weren't there, at one time? All packed into it. They used to say that crossroads really was the most congested crossroads in the world. Because of the way the traffic was going through it, day and night.
Did you witness the bombing of Caen?
Oh, yes. Went out and sat on a hilltop and watched it. And I still think, I hadn't got a very clear idea then, but I have a very clear idea now about it, and I think it was the most awful thing, the most awful, unnecessary thing, really. It did nothing but harm to us and to everybody else.
Any other incidents that happened to you in Normandy?
Well, I did a one-man reconnaissance of the Falaise Gap. My colonel believed that young officers shouldn't drive jeeps. If they had to go on something that was important, then they were allowed to have a jeep provided they didn't drive it themselves but were driven by a driver. But usually there wasn't a driver available, and if there wasn't a driver available, you couldn't have a jeep. You had to go on a motorbike. And so I was sent to do a reconnaissance of the Falaise Gap on a motorbike.
What did you say?
Well, I was supposed to report back on an estimate of at how serious a blow this had been for the German forces and whether it was possible to identify the units there, or more particularly, whether you could identify the units that weren't there, which would mean that they'd escaped from the pincer movement that was taking place. And so I had to go and look at vehicles and bodies and equipment of all sorts. The horses are the worst. They smelt the worst. It was a very interesting trip.
What had caused most of the casualties and damage to the Germans?
The fighter bombers. What were they called?
Typhoons,
yes. Yes. But I don't think even now that we realize, I suppose military historians do, but I often wonder whether people realized how much of the German army was horse-drawn, even as late as 1944, perhaps more in 1944 than earlier because of the shortage of petrol. But the terrible thing in the Falaise, when a lot of German units get caught like they were there, is the number of horses that are killed.
What happened to you on the breakout?
On the breakout? Well, I went to Brussels to take part in the party that was going on, which you spoke about earlier. I don't know what information I was carrying. Because I wasn't cleared for, as we just said, about ULTRA and so on. But it was certainly some sort of either confirmation from an ULTRA source or something like that I was carrying. And I remember I had to catch up with 30 Corps, which by then was way, way, way ahead and out of all normal communication by telephone or anything else. And I finally got to Brussels before I caught 30 Corps.
What do you remember about the reception from the population then?
Well, yes, unforgettable. I never went into Paris because, of course, Paris was in the American sector. So I know nothing about the liberation of Paris, but the liberation of Brussels was quite unforgettable. They really went crazy. And because they are much more skilled at black market operations than most of the other people on the continent, they were able to produce stocks of all sorts of things to celebrate with. You know, every Belgian family had an enormous great wine cellar full of, which they'd hidden away against the day when they'd be liberated.
Were the Germans still in the city when you went in?
No. There was a certain amount of sporadic shooting, but you couldn't distinguish between the shooting of the which might have been left over from the from a rear guard and the shooting which was simply celebration.
Did you ever come across any coolness or hostility from any of the continental peoples, France, Belgium or Netherlands? Towards the Allied forces?
Well, there was a certain amount of hostility in France. But this was mainly because of destruction and losses. And, I mean, there was a certain amount of hostility in Caen. Who could blame them?
How did that manifest itself?
One heard all sorts of remarks, you know. It was a very sad affair, Caen, altogether. No, I never came across anything in Belgium or Holland, except that the Dutch were much more understanding, I think. The Dutch attitude, and I'm jumping ahead a bit here now, but the Dutch attitude after the Arnhem business, when it became quite apparent that there was going to be a whole piece of the Netherlands that was not going to be liberated immediately, and where they suffered terribly. But the Dutch in places like Eindhoven, where I had most to do with them, were fairly understanding about that. They seem to be able to take into account the fact that they couldn't hope for their country to be liberated immediately, or indeed that year. Whereas in Belgium, they were much less understanding. They couldn't understand in Belgium, or they said they couldn't understand why Brussels and Antwerp couldn't be liberated together. They were very far apart, and yet Antwerp was quite a long time before Antwerp was liberated.
What were you doing at the time of Arnhem? Still with the same job?
Oh, yes.
And the Ardennes offensive?
Yes, I was doing the same job all the time. I didn't change at all, right to the end. I didn't do anything special about Arnhem at all. I was never involved in any trips or anything like that in Arnhem.
How did you come to be in personal contact with Montgomery himself?
Well, that's this business of the surrender, that was. But
can you take me through the story of that in detail, step by step, please?
Well, I suppose I can. Let me see. First of all, you have to understand that in a formation as big as an army, and even more, this applies to an army group, that there are several headquarters. And so the Second Army had a main headquarters, where I was. It had a rear headquarters, which was a long, long way back, which was concerned mainly with supply and all the things which didn't have to be, which weren't absolutely essential for operations, but which would come along later. And then it has a TAC headquarters, tactical headquarters, where only the army commander and a very small staff were and operated. So there were three. And it was just the same with Army Group. Army Group had a main headquarters, which, because it was an army group, was also a long way back. And then it had a rear headquarters, and I'm not sure the rear headquarters ever got out of this country. It may not have done, but it certainly was so far back that it perhaps didn't even cross the channel. Or it may have amalgamated with the Chafe headquarters. And then it had a TAC headquarters. Now, the TAC headquarters is very important in the case of the Army Group, because this was Montgomery's personal way of running things, was to live all the time in a TAC headquarters, tactical headquarters, with a very small staff, and never, or virtually never, go to his main headquarters. People had to come to him. And when he left his TAC headquarters, he always went forward. Never back to his main headquarters, but always forward to see the units that were under his command and the troops in the field. So this was his way of doing it. I'm telling you this because all this takes place at TAC headquarters, 21 Army Group. And I was not there. I was only at main headquarters, 2nd Army. And so what is called for is some explanation of how and why I went from one to the other. We have to go back, I think, to the 30th of April, which was a Monday, if I remember rightly. 45 I'm talking about now, 45. 30th of April, 45. We used to listen to the German radio every night. Not the German army radio, but the ordinary German, what was being put out to the German public from German radio stations. And on that day, they put out the story, surrounded with sad music and so on, that Hitler was dead and that he had delegated his role as Führer to Admiral Dönitz. And this came, I don't know when, probably about midnight on that day. And this was obviously the beginning of the end. And the next day, which would have been May the 1st, a message was received by somebody or other, I think somebody in 30 Corps probably, which said that the Dönitz, the new Führer of the German Reich, Dönitz, had decided that the time had come to ask the Allies for an armistice or a peace or a ceasefire. And this was followed up by a message which came from Blumentritt, who was a German general who was well known to everybody in the British Army because he'd fought all over the place and he commanded a division in Normandy. And by that time, he was commanding what was left of the German army around the Hamburg area, Hamburg and further east from Hamburg, Lübeck and along the Elbe. And a message came from Blumentritt saying that he was going to send somebody to discuss surrender. So everybody immediately got worked up about this and said, this is it. It's going to happen today. And nothing happened. Usual thing with the army, of course, nothing happened.